On this week's 51%, Army critics speak up about sexual harassment. A brewery launches a diversity and inclusion initiative.
I don't want to be the only Black woman everywhere I go for the next however many years I'm in this business.
And Dr. Jerry Byrne shares her view on being masked. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Critics say the Army is not doing enough to address sexual harassment and sexual assault in the ranks. The outcry comes after the killing this past spring of Fort Hood soldier Vanessa Guillen. Her family says Guillen's alleged killer had been harassing her, but she was afraid to report it. Army leaders say they are addressing the issue. From San Antonio, Texas, Jolene Almendares reports for the American Homefront Project.
Thousands of people have joined forces online and in protests across the country to make their voices heard about rape, sexual harassment, and assault in the military. San Antonio Army veteran Sarah is one of them. She says she experienced everything from sexual comments to attempted rape. It started in basic training and then got worse.
That's when everything else started happening, like the guy slapping my ass, them making comments about the things that they would do. And I mean, and it went all the way from privates to master sergeants and lieutenants.
Sarah asked that we not use her last name because she fears harassment or revenge. She says those kinds of sexual comments were normal in the military.
You work in an environment as a female, and it's a predominantly male environment. And men talk, you know, men say things that they shouldn't say, and it's just a joke. I mean, we had guys that would come in and tell us about what they did to their wife last night.
Sarah says a sergeant sexually assaulted her after a night of playing pool and drinking. He took photos of her and showed other soldiers they worked with. She says later, a lieutenant tried to rape her at a friend's apartment. The Army says none of this is supposed to happen. In 2006, it launched the Sexual Harassment Assault Response and Prevention Program, called SHARP. Jim Hellis oversees the Army SHARP program.
These are issues of critical importance, not only to our readiness, but to taking care of soldiers. It is an item of importance to every commander up and down the chain of command.
This is how he says SHARP is supposed to work. Soldiers who are harassed or assaulted can file either a restricted or unrestricted report. Restricted reports allow them to get medical help and other services and are withheld from the chain of command, but they can't seek legal action against the perpetrator. Unrestricted reports allow legal action, but the soldier's chain of command is told about the investigation. According to the Department of Defense, about 25% of women in the military reported sexual harassment in 2018. The numbers increased about 10% the next year. Reported sexual assault increased about 3%. But the Army doesn't necessarily think that's a bad thing. Hellis says it's a sign that the SHARP program is making a difference.
What we've seen over the last several years is we've seen increases in the numbers of reports and the percentage of cases that are being reported with women. I take that as signs that there is increasing confidence in the chain of command and in confidence in the system to report incidents of sexual assault, sexual harassment.
There's no way to know if the increased number of reports are because the SHARP program is working well or if more people are being victimized. But there's a gap in what is being reported and what people are experiencing. For instance, Sarah never reported the comments, sexual assault, or attempted rape.
So I had other friends that I would talk to, and they would tell me, like, well, I made a SHARP complaint, and nothing ever got done about it.
And her experience in the Army isn't unique.
I can't think of one woman that can say she's never experienced sexual harassment.
That's Deshauna Barber, CEO of the Service Women's Action Network, known as SWAN. She's been an Army reservist for around 10 years. Barber said Army culture lacks a basic understanding of what sexual harassment means, despite regular training on it. And she says even when sex crimes are reported, perpetrators aren't necessarily discharged from the Army or even prosecuted.
I see soldiers get kicked out of the military so often for DUIs and drug-related offenses. I have yet to see someone get kicked out for sexual harassment or sexual assault. And that is the absolute problem.
There are efforts in Congress to take on some of the barriers soldiers face when reporting sex crimes. But unless the military culture changes, activists say that might still not be enough. I'm Jolene Almendares in San Antonio.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. A new report says an estimated 500,000 more girls risk being forced into child marriage, and as many as 1 million more are expected to become pregnant this year as a result of the economic impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, a year-over-year increase of 4% and 3% respectively. This is according to analysis from Save the Children, where officials say the increase comes on top of the previous estimated rates of child marriage, which already anticipated 12 million girls being forced into marriage this year. They say that while this increase represents a conservative estimate, it marks a significant surge in child marriage rates, with an expected spike in teenage pregnancies and school dropouts to follow. The increase is set to reverse 25 years of progress, which saw child marriage rates decline. In its new report, Global Girlhood 2020, COVID-19 and Progress in Peril, Save the Children analyzed the impact of COVID-19 on gender equality. The report also shows that although data is limited, girls affected by humanitarian crises, like wars, floods, droughts, earthquakes, and disease outbreaks, face the greatest risk of child marriage. It points out that gender-based violence was a pandemic long before COVID-19, with an estimated 1 in 10 girls globally having experienced rape or sexual violence from a current or former boyfriend or husband. Based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, Kim Hines has been a theater artist for 50-plus years. Now she has written her first book. This story was produced by KFAI's Dixie Trichel.
The name of my book is called Wingo Fly, a Novella. The story takes place in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1965. A young black man who's missing and presumed murdered is dead, and his spirit connects up with a little 10-year-old black girl in the community named Christy Wingo. She, through a series of visions and interactions, leads the community and the police to find out what happened to this young man. My name is Kim Hines. I'm a theater artist, playwright, director, a union actor, and an educator. This book is a YA fiction book, meaning young adult fiction. I like writing for middle schoolers. They want to explore. They still believe in magic. They have a lot of imagination. This excerpt is when Christy starts to observe the number three. Remember when I said that things were happening in threes? Well, they're numbers, you know. I wasn't ever into numbers until I heard Sister Ray talking about numbers that day in church. Three is the most magical number there is. It's all through the Bible. Most numbers in a good book are divisible by three. All the women in the sewing circle were nodding their heads in agreement. And y'all know bad things, bad times, and bad luck come in threes. I know because I had me three husbands. This book is really based on when I was 10 years old in 1965. Christy is a lot like me. I grew up in Minneapolis. I'm second generation Minnesotan. My mother was born here. My father's from Kentucky. We don't have a lot of stories about black people growing up in the Midwest. We were middle class. There's not a lot of stories about black kids growing up in a middle class family. There's a lot of books out there about kids growing up in poverty and growing up in gangs and, you know, all the stereotypes that I think white America has about black people. And growing up, I don't think I read anything that spoke to the way I was living. I've been coming up for hills and mountains. This excerpt is when Christy and her mother are talking, and they wind up talking about Sister Ray. Sister Ray says she's not afraid of white folks, and she says, look, let me tell you something. my mother snaps at me, angry, and cuts me off before I get a chance to finish my sentence. Sometimes being scared is the smartest thing you can be. Sometimes being scared can save your life. Now, Sister Ray is not the only one who spent some time down south, Missy. Some of us have our own stories to tell, and they are not filled with lies about not being afraid. The George Floyd murder happened about 6 or 7 blocks from where I grew up in South Minneapolis, which would be Christie's neighborhood. So where he was killed on 38th in Chicago, Christie would know exactly where that is, because she would have to cross 38th in Chicago to get to her favorite Dairy Queen. It was like deja vu all over again. I'm telling you, the George Floyd murder, it has affected me as an artist, because I'm still trying to work through the trauma and the pain. I'm also trying to work through what happened here and why it happened and why does it continue to happen. And because we artists, we write about life. Art reflects life. And so it's very significant that I can't necessarily write about it at this time because I'm going through it. This book becomes a stepping stone for a lot of parents and adults to talk about certain issues. You can talk about the birds and the bees, the civil rights movement, the relationship between Black communities and the police. There's just a lot of issues that can be broached through this book.
That was theater artist and author Kim Hines speaking about her book, Wingo Fly. The piece was produced by KFAI's Dixie Treichel. A brewery in the Hudson Valley region of New York, Dutchess County to be specific, is starting a paid internship program to promote diversity and inclusion in the craft beverage industry. Sloop Brewing Company in East Fishkill is launching Open Waters, a part-time internship program intended to fill what are anemic ranks when it comes to women and non-white hires and owners. The internship idea sprung from conversations over the summer about whether to participate in the Black is Beautiful initiative, a collaborative effort among the brewing community and its customers in an attempt to bring awareness to the injustices that many people of color face daily. There is a basic stout recipe upon which breweries could build to make the beer their own and donate 100% of the beer's proceeds to local foundations that support police brutality reform and legal defenses for those who have been wronged. Marikita Reese is a Sloop brewer and chairwoman of Sloop's Diversity and Inclusion Committee.
We're coming from a place of, yeah, awareness is good. Donating to a cause is great. You know, put your money where your mouth is and donate your proceeds to social justice in whatever way you see fit. I think those are all great things for a brewery to do. But we decided we could take it a step further. With this training system in place and, you know, through creating an internship program, it basically gives us a way to promote equity and diversity and social justice through not only our time, but our money, energy, and our effort as a company to promote social justice within the Hudson Valley and within our own company.
Reese says she helped form the Diversity and Inclusion Committee in August.
We basically came to the first Diversity and Inclusion Committee meeting with some statistics and articles that we had printed out, and we were in the research stages at that point trying to figure out if we could even do this type of program here. And what we were citing was a 2018 Brewers Association report. I guess they had sent out a survey to most breweries in the country, and the numbers that came back were astounding as far as lack of diversity. It was, I think, 97% white male owned and operated at that point. I'm not sure what the current numbers are as far as 2020 goes. It's been a little tumultuous, you know, lots of openings and closings as far as breweries are concerned. So I don't know what the current numbers are, but just seeing that at that time was pretty upsetting and shocking for all of us. Like, we knew it was a problem. We just didn't know how staggering of a problem it was at the time.
Not even 97%, you know, white male owned and operated, but employment too. It's I don't know exactly what the numbers were, but if there's virtually no, there's very little diversity in the brewing industry.
Mm-hmm.
Adam Watson is president and co-founder of Sloop Brewing. He hopes the program is replicated and is proud to host such a program and get it off the ground during the coronavirus pandemic. Again, Reese.
I'm hoping with this program that we can strengthen the workforce of not just the Hudson Valley, but of the brewing industry overall. That's a really important goal of mine. And the hope is that there's more of a chance for different type of people to end up in this industry that I love so much, but I don't want to be the only Black woman everywhere I go for the next however many years I'm in this business. It's, you know, it's far overdue.
She says Sloop is the first brewery in the region to kick off such an initiative, and likely the first in the state to put together a program that introduces skills to a specific population. Reese tells how she entered the industry.
Well, a lot of the reason why I'm so passionate about this project is because of how difficult it was for me to get into this industry. My story of how I became a professional brewer is a long and painful one, but the short of it is I had this interest in 2017 and it was just lining up with around the time I was dropping out of a pre-law program. And there was an opening for a six-month brewing and distilling course, but it was an hour away from my house. But because I was technically a low-income student at the time, I was advised to apply, and it was paid for by New York State. So I went to this six-month brewing and distilling course up in Schenectady for free. The only thing I had to give was my time and energy to that program. And then when I came out, I had a ton of really good base experience. I couldn't find a job anywhere within my hometown. So I started expanding my search, had to take a job on the canning line at a brewery about 2 hours away from my house. So I was commuting down to Westchester and back full time for almost a year. Captain Lawrence.
I just had a feeling. Reese was living in Catskill at the time and now calls Kingston her home.
We basically start the intern from the very beginning, the canning line and packaging department. So we'll start there. If they can handle it and do well throughout that department, they then move on to the cellar, which is where we do all of our dry hopping and our yeast pitching. And that's where we do all of the cleaning on all of the fermenters. If they can master that, then the third step is to move over to the brew house itself and start learning how to brew.
Reese says Sloop Brewing would hire one intern per quarter, with the first one to start in January.
This is Bird Note. Take a walk around any local pond or lake in late November, and you'll find ducks in their most brilliant breeding colors. The male, or drake mallards, sparkle their greenest on their heads and necks, and their bills are now golden yellow. Green-winged teal males are at full luster. Every detail of their complex plumage precisely delineated. Male northern shovelers have regained their deep emerald head feathers and rich brown flanks. After months of molting out of their nondescript late summer feathers, known as eclipse plumage, male dabbling ducks look their finest in late fall and winter. Because for most ducks, this is the season of courtship and pair bonding. Males display and chase females and fend off other males to win a mate with whom they'll migrate in spring to their nesting grounds. That's a schedule quite different from the usual timetable of songbirds, which sing and court and find mates in the spring, after migrating to a nesting area. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein. Support for BirdNote comes from the Cornell Labs Bird Academy, with online courses that share the wonder and joy of birds. More at allaboutbirds.org.
And now, writer Dr. Jerry Burns explores what she calls the incognito factor.
Have you ever gone to a costume party or participated in cosplay? I haven't done those things exactly, but I've dressed up for Halloween, worn costumes when working at historic preservation sites, and at various events while homeschooling my son. Cancel culture and J.K. Rowling notwithstanding, back in the day I also dressed up for midnight Harry Potter book release lines. I loved becoming Molly Weasley, the archetype of a fierce, creative, self-reliant, protective, and magical mama. One thing I've never done was wear a complete disguise. I mean, I haven't robbed a bank or held up a train, so I've never had a need for bandit wear. The point being that I have never been unrecognizable. Until now. The first time I made a public appearance since lockdown, I was wearing my usual hat and sunglasses. And to protect self and others, I wore the homemade face mask generously crafted and given to me by Sue Gamache, a friend and folk festival colleague. Anyway, I approached someone I knew from a social distance. They looked at me with that spooked cat look that some folks display when a person outside their bubble gets near. My friend didn't really know me. So I removed my sunglasses and happiness reigned. My friend smiled, waved, and like old Hollywood stars, we kiss-kissed and air-hugged and, well, now about those pandemic air-hugs. They look special. You open your arms wide at the same time as someone else, and it's like you both are holding an invisible beach ball fit for a giant. Now, the experience of passing as not me was my first glimpse into what I'll call the incognito factor, which is the good side of wearing masks beyond slowing the transmission of the virus. Now, I know there's a huge controversy about masks, that some people feel challenged when wearing them, and like everyone else, I'm painfully aware of how masks have been politicized. I'm not here to debate the merits of any argument for or against masks. I'm here to simply share three benefits of wearing masks that have nothing to do with politics and COVID-19 and have all to do with the incognito factor. Benefit number one, wearing a mask is a gift for those with introverted leanings. While I do like my social gatherings, I have also very much enjoyed being home during the pandemic because I don't have to be on. While I miss friends and even gas stations, I'm not always up for social gatherings. I'm the type who has to be in the mood for a social event. I need time to psych myself up in advance. But with a mask on my face, I don't have to interact with a soul, and I insult no one. You don't have to have introvert in your DNA to enjoy this mask positive. I mean, if you bump into someone who you don't want to talk to, put on your mask, sunglasses, and your hat, and you too can taste the incognito factor just like a Hollywood star. A second benefit is that when you wear a mask, you save on sunscreen. Between the mask, my bangs, sunglasses, and the hat on my head, I have no need to put any sunscreen on my face. The mask protects my skin from sinister UV rays, wrinkles, and sunscreen chemicals. While the cost savings on sunscreen don't exactly add up to a stimulus check, they can't hurt. And there's this. Your mask is insurance coverage against doing Hollywood-style work to fix your aging face. Instead, use your mask and you're good. So that's another positive benefit to wearing a mask. The third reason is completely different, but one that I value most of all. I am a storyteller and a part-time college instructor, so I do a little talking for a living. I also rehearse for a living. The other day, my family and I were biking on the rail trail on a weekday when it was lightly populated. Because we passed people every so often, I put on my mask. I was ahead of the family pack, so while riding, I talked through a presentation I was about to record for college students. Normally, when I practice stories or presentations in public, onlookers scrutinize me as I animatedly and unabashedly talk to myself. But the random cyclist that passed me by on the rail trail that day had no idea that I was involved in a serious conversation with me. No one could see through the mask. It's great. With a simple mask over my face, voila, I have my own Hollywood star's private rehearsal studio, but without the rental fee. So, if you wear a mask, you too can live like a Hollywood star. Wear a mask and revel in the incognito factor as you easily avoid those paparazzi and unwanted attention from fans or neighbors. You can air hug and kiss from a safe distance, get work done on your skin without a plastic surgeon or medical fees, and rehearse your lines in the privacy of your own face. There really are benefits to wearing masks for those who can manage them that have nothing to do with COVID-19 or politics. Now, it's said that when life gives you lemons, to turn them into lemonade. To which I say, when life gives you masks, turn them into masquerades.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1635.